The Son as the Image of God, Part 2, was presented by Ryan Carroll on April 11, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. good afternoon to everybody. I've been successfully able to parlay my 2 weeks into a third week, and I will not do a fourth. If you have your handout in front of you, we are, the last couple weeks that I've taught, my goal has been to go through Colossians chapter 1, verses 12 and through 22, specifically. And although I did spend a week prior to kind of setting that up, I don't really have the time to do a review that would be just for any of you who didn't or weren't here those 2 weeks or didn't listen. So, did I say something funny? Oh, right, yeah. Okay, so if you were listening and great. I am just going to quickly just make mention of a few things, and then ultimately we're going to spend the rest of our time down under where I've labeled it point two this week. I'll read through the section again before we do, though. So real quickly, what I've proposed is that to understand this passage, you have to have the right background in mind. And what I propose is that the background that you need to have an understanding of is the Davidic covenant. And specifically that the titles and the things that are said about Jesus by the gospel accounts and by the apostles all come from that covenant. And so, as I mentioned for the last 2 weeks, the term Messiah, the term Son of God, these are not unique terms to Jesus. So they must be understood in view of the Jewish Bible. Okay, David was the first Son of God, and so forth and so on, if you were here for the last couple weeks. Last week, we turned to Colossians itself, and before we did, I mentioned that aside from the Davidic covenant needing to be in our background, the context for Colossians itself is that Paul is writing to a group of people that are fairly new to the faith, and he has one specific purpose in mind, and that is to warn these Gentile believers of the persuasion that is going to come in the form of Pharisaical Judaism, and with groups such as the Party of the Circumcision, that they are to not be swayed into thinking that they have to become oriented rightly to the Mosaic Covenant to partake in the blessing of Abraham. So that is his sole focus in the letter to Colossae. Again, as I mentioned last week, I don't have time to defend that. A number of people would tell you that Paul is not solely focused on Judaism, but they're wrong. So now, I'm just going to read through what I did last week, make a few comments, and then jump into point two. If you were looking at my translation, the handout, for the first time, you'll notice that on the left-hand side is the New American Standard Version, and I have put some spaces in there to correspond to what I think the rhetorical outline of Paul is, and you'll see those on my translation as well. And of course, on the right-hand side is my translation. I'm going to just read through it, and then we'll go for it. Okay, Colossians 1:12 through 22. Giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you by the light to share in the inheritance of the set apart ones. And as I mentioned last week, the inheritance is the blessing of Abraham, spoken of in Genesis, who delivered us out of the rule of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. So what I've proposed is that to these Gentile readers, Paul is making the statement, you have been qualified by the Father. You do not need to be oriented to the Mosaic Covenant and to Judaism in any way, shape, or form. You've been qualified. You stand to inherit the blessing of Abraham. Now, he brings up the phrase that they have been transferred into the kingdom of the Son. And as I mentioned, the Son, of course, as we know, is the title given to the fulfiller of the Davidic covenant. Excuse me. So now what he's going to do is he's going to make two points about who this Son is. And I went through the first point last week. And so this is point one of two. Verse 15, this one, the ruler over all creation, is the image of the invisible God. That is, as image of God, all things in the heavens and upon the earth, the visible and invisible things, were created for him, that is, for his benefit. And I would just pause real quickly to mention that, of course, the New American Standard translates this completely differently. I mentioned this last week, but it just makes a lot more sense to me to understand Paul not suggesting that Jesus was the agent of creation, but as the fulfiller of the Davidic covenant, as the firstborn, that is, the one who stands to inherit God's all of what is God's, that it makes far more sense to me to take the language that all things have been created for his benefit. That is, he will receive as inheritor, as God's firstborn, creation. He will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords over that creation. Yes, even thrones and dominions, continuing on, even rulers and authorities, all things were created on the basis of him and for him. Verse 17, and he, as image of God, is above, that is, of greater status than all people, and all people are united in their subjection to him. And he, as image of God, is the ruler or head over the grouping, that is, the body of the ekklesia, and that's the Greek word that always gets translated church. And as I pointed out last week, that the ekklesia is literally the called out ones. In Greek, the two words that come together to make that word are called out. And so who's he talking about? Well, he's talking about those who have been transferred out of the darkness into the kingdom of the Son, both Jew and Gentile, I would assert. Now we're to point two. Now, I'm just going to read through it and then see what happens. Okay, 18b, this one, the ruler, brought out from the dead, is the beginning, with the result that he might be made first in all respects. That is, as beginning, he, the Father, was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him, the Son, and by him, the Son, to reconcile all people to himself, the Father, by the blood of his, that is, the Son's cross, whether those who are upon the earth or those who are in the heavens. Okay. All right, so, first of all, I just want to point out that point one and two start very similarly. Back up in point one, there's the two statements that he makes that he's the firstborn and he is the image of the invisible God. And you'll see down in 18b, point two, is that he's the firstborn and he is the beginning. And what I mentioned 2 weeks ago was that It seems to me that Paul is wanting to make his main point be one of those two things. And the other title or the other thing that he's saying is subservient to his main point. So I've made the decision that in point one, his main point is that he's the image of the invisible God. And in point two, I've made the decision that his main point is that he, the Son, is the beginning. And we'll talk about what that means. But that leaves, if you see the pattern, that leaves both up in 15 and down in 18, the statement about the Son being firstborn to be a defining clause in apposition to his main point. So that what I'm suggesting is that firstborn is a way for Paul to further define who it is that he's talking about. Okay. Now, as you, if you were here, you would, you'll remember that I am making the case that firstborn is a messianic title, that this was a title that was first given to David by God, and the reference for that is Psalm 89. So, up in verse 15, he's the ruler that rules over, he's the firstborn, that is the ruler that rules over all creation. And what I'm suggesting down at 18b is that he is the ruler that was brought up from the dead. Okay? Now, even someone a couple weeks ago had some questions or concerns over how I was taking firstborn down in 18b. I am indeed suggesting that it is a title. Now you'll notice over in the NASB translation that it's simply translated firstborn from the dead. And I want to talk about why I'm suggesting that firstborn here should be understood as a title, not as a description of Jesus being resurrected. I'm going to grant that Jesus was the first man to ever be raised from the dead. That's just not true. As Jack pointed out last week during the Easter service, he is indeed the first man who was raised to a new type or level of existence. But I don't think that that's Paul's main point here. His main point is that he is the beginning. Now, the question is, the beginning of what? If his point is that he is the beginning of a new type of resurrected existence, then it makes sense that firstborn would be denoting the actual resurrection, that he is being born from the dead. But I am going to make the case that that is not his, that is not his, his main point. In English, the term firstborn is a participle carrying the verbal weight of the action of birth. That is why when we see the term firstborn in English, firstborn from the dead, our minds are instantly conditioned to attach that verbal significance to the word and to grant the word's metaphorical usage here in direct correspondence to the action of rising from the dead. That is, he, the Son, is the first to be literally resurrected, that is, born from the dead. However, in Greek, the word born, it's takos, is not a participle, but rather a noun. Firstborn doesn't have the verbal connotation in Greek that English forces upon it. So, the term firstborn, it's prototakos in the Greek, throws the emphasis of the focus onto the person, not to the actual action of the rising, if that makes sense. So in this case, the Son just is the firstborn, that is, he's the messianic title firstborn, who is raised out from the dead. It's the phrase out from the dead that gives the connotation or the understanding, the meaning of resurrection, okay, not the word firstborn. Now, prototakos is used 8 times in the New Testament, and I'm going to make the argument that I'm going to make the argument that out of those 8 times, five of those occurrences are used as messianic titles. The other three, two of the occurrences have to do with the literal child of the parents being the first child. And the last one in Romans 8 has to do with Jesus being the firstborn among many brethren. And I would, I'm not going to get into that, but it's very, very much, you can interpret it. You don't have to interpret it as being focused on the resurrection itself. So what is my point? My point is that all eight occurrences in the New Testament have literally nothing specifically to do with the resurrection itself. That is, that firstborn is not being used by the New Testament authors to denote the rising from the dead. Rather, I would suggest it is being used as a title. Couple of examples of this are in Hebrews. Hebrews 1, verse 6, the writer of Hebrews is quoting and says, "When he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says of him, 'Let all the angels worship him.'" Very much a messianic title, very much having the Davidic covenant in view. The second occurrence that would be an example of a title would be in Hebrews chapter 12, where the church is called the church of the firstborn. And I think what the writer of Hebrews has in mind is that it is the firstborn, that is Messiah Jesus, whose church it is, whose grouping of people it is that he is ruling over. So, now, one of the problems is that we have always considered firstborn to be referring to the resurrection, because as far as I know, in terms of evangelical tradition, we have never really considered firstborn as a messianic title. Okay, and that's what I'm suggesting it is. Okay. Finally, it needs to be noted that the resurrection of Jesus in the minds of the apostles is first and foremost a confirmation of his messiahship. That is, that when the apostles are talking about the resurrection, they are doing so to point specifically to the fact that God didn't leave him dead, therefore the things that Jesus had to say about himself are absolutely true. And what did he say about himself? Well, he said that he was the Son of God, the fulfiller of the Davidic covenant. So I have, I went through the New Testament. There are over 16 places where, in terms of the resurrection, what's being talked about and what the apostles are saying, there's over 16 places where it's simply being discussed as a confirmation of his messiahship. Only secondarily is the resurrection talked about and discussed in terms of believers getting to also share in that life one day. So that said, I am taking firstborn as to be a title. And so when he says, "This one, the firstborn brought out from the dead," Paul is very much just using "out from the dead." He's referencing the resurrection to point to the fact that indeed this is the fulfiller of the Davidic covenant. This one is indeed the firstborn of God. Okay. Now, if that's not his main point, the question is, how is the Son the beginning? What is Paul talking about? Now, before I'm going to take that on, I need to go ahead and explain verse 19, and then I will come back to verse 18b to talk about how it is that he's the beginning. Before I do, though, I just want to point out that I think the beginning is a decent way to translate this. The New American Standard does it this way. The word in the Greek is arche, and typically it can be translated ruler or beginning. It makes no sense to be translated ruler. He's been talking about Jesus as ruler over and over already. So I think beginning is good, but I'm going to suggest that what may be closer to Paul's intention is a synonym, something like like the foundation or the basis of. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. So beginning, foundation, or basis of, that's Paul's main point. That is his second point here. Okay, so we've come to, and I'll also going to come back to what I have made as a parenthetical statement. I'll come back to that as well. So I'm going to skip to 19, and then we'll come back once 19 has been made clear. Okay, maybe the moment everyone's been waiting for. Verse 19 says, that is, as beginning, so whatever Paul means by that, he, the Father, was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him, that is, the Son. Okay, so I want to point out that, first of all, this this is the verse that traditional theology will point to suggest that that what we are to understand that Jesus is he is the fullness of God. That is, that his ontology, his biology, his makeup is that of God. And so this verse very much gets translated and understood in that way. And I would say helping it do that is the fact that in Colossians chapter 2, verse 9, there's a very similar statement made by Paul that goes something like, and in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. Okay, so here the statement is, the Father was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him. In Colossians 2, 9, the statement is, and in him, the Son, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. Now, the translators of the New American Standard have very much coupled those two and suggested that we should understand them to be talking about the same thing. I am going to suggest that they're talking about the same thing, but I'm going to suggest that they're referring to something altogether different than what traditional theology tells us that it means. You can even look in the margins of your New American Standard in chapter 1, verse 19, and you will see that they will offer the possible translation that what they're referring to, what Paul's referring to, is the fullness of deity, as though that is somehow really clarifying. So how many of you, I just want to show of hands, how many of you have ever been confused about this or have wondered what fullness means? Anyone? Okay. All right. The rest of you are just liars. Okay. Now, traditional evangelical theology wants to view this whole passage that I have been unfolding as a treatise on how Jesus is God, that he is creator, and how he is before all things in time, and that he is fully God in his ontological nature. My problem is that aside from this view being dismissive of the Davidic covenant, I would suggest, that view of this passage is also completely dismissive of the context of Colossians itself. Paul's whole project in this letter is to tell Gentile believers that they don't have to become Jewish in their orientation to receive the blessing of Abraham. So my question is, then how does it make sense for Paul to be like focusing on the ontological nature of Jesus if he's really wanting to explain to Gentiles how they don't have to become Jewish? So, I mean, I can understand how it maybe works for some people, but I'm going to suggest something that I think is far clearer in terms of what Paul is doing with Colossians itself. Now, before I offer my take on the language, I just want to tell you that I've come up with like three or four different takes on what fullness means, and I each in its own time has made like all the sense in the world. And I don't know if you've ever heard this from this pulpit, but I'm going to tell you this, that I will never change my mind about what I've decided here. So, I'm just going to step out on that. Okay, first of all, so you guys, I'm just going to kind of pull you along here. So, verse 19, that is, as beginning, he, the Father, was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him, the Son. Now, the Father, the word Father is not there in the Greek. The verb pleased is in the third person singular, and so it's up to us to decide who it is that he's talking about. And I think that the NASB has it exactly right, that it is the Father who is pleased here. Now, pleased, I think, is synonymous with, that it's God's intention, this is his purpose, so that he was pleased for this to happen is to say that this was his intention for this to happen. Okay? Now, the question is, what was his intention? Before I give my secret away, I just want everyone to recall that the context here is that Paul is explaining how the Son is the beginning, or the foundation. So, the question is, what is the fullness? What is it that is dwelling in the Son? My suggestion is that that is the wrong question to ask. The question should not be what, but rather the question should be who. It's not what is dwelling in the Son, it's who is dwelling in the Son. And I'm suggesting that the fullness that Paul is talking about here is the full complement of both Jews and Gentiles who have been marked out by God to receive the inheritance of Abraham, that is his blessing. It is those who are in the Son, that is those who dwell or find their home in him, which I think is just a fancy way to say that his disciples. But it is those people who will be the inheritors of the blessing. It is those people who are the true people of God. So just to recap, the fullness is that group of people that includes the Jews and the Gentiles. Okay, now, have I just come up with this off the top of my head? Well, there are some verses that I'm going to quickly point to that give some credence to my take here. If everyone would turn to Ephesians chapter 1 real quickly. At the very end of Ephesians chapter 1, I'm going to read it. We're going to start in verse 22. Now, in verse 22 and 23, I'm going to suggest the same thing that I did 2 weeks ago, that when the NASB translates it all things, it really is all people. So I'm going to read it that way. Verse 22, and he, that is God, put all people in subjection under his Son's feet and gave him as head over all people to the church, which is his body, the fullness. That is the same word that we find in Colossians chapter 1, the fullness of him who fills all in all. So the fullness, again, is a word that Paul has decided that he is simply going to use as a synonym for the body of believers, both Jews and Gentiles, who are going to inherit this blessing. One more place that I won't have you turn to, but in Romans chapter 11, Paul is talking about, he's turned to his readers, and he has told them to not be arrogant towards the truth. Because indeed, it was the Jews who are the people of God, and it is the Jews who are ultimately still going to be saved. Now, in one place, as you all probably know, he says that God is going to wait until the fullness of the Gentiles enters in, and then all Israel is going to be saved. And so I think what you have in Romans 11 is a very clear statement of the fullness. And he starts by describing the first half of the fullness, that is the fullness of the Gentiles. It is the Gentile believers who God is at work now to bring into his kingdom. And once that fullness comes in, then all Israel is going to come in. That is the fullness of the Jews. And those two together make the fullness, that is, in Colossians 1, the Father was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him, that is Jesus. Okay. So it's not as sexy as traditional theology would like to make it out to be. But I think that understanding just makes so much more sense in this context. So now the question is, if we go back to verse 18, how, in what sense is the Son the beginning or the foundation? And I'm going to kind of read from my notes. I want to say it right. So I'm going to read. The Son is the beginning because it's on the basis or the foundation of him, that is, by being in him, that people are granted the inheritance, the blessing of Abraham. God is putting together his people, the full complement of both Jews and Gentiles, based upon their being named as a people through the seed of Abraham, that is the Son who is Christ, not based upon their physical lineage to Abraham himself. And if you note in Genesis chapter 22, after God stops Abraham from sacrificing his son, he says, because you have done this thing, Abraham, it is through you, and he says, it is in your seed that all the world will be blessed. Now, the book of, and the seed, we're going to talk about that a little bit, but the book of Genesis goes into quite a lot of detail about following the lineage of the blessing. It is not Ishmael who God will bring it through. It's Isaac who is the child of promise. But Paul, in both Romans and even more so in Galatians, is clear that it's the seed of Abraham, referenced in Genesis 22, through which all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Paul's contention in Galatians 3, you don't have to go there, but that's where he makes it as clear as possible. Paul's contention is that the seed is a line or a group of descendants that was going to be named through the Christ alone, not Abraham. That is, God's plan has always been to bring the inheritance to those who find their lineage or their home in the Christ. It is through his singular lineage, that is, this group of descendants, not Abraham's, through whom the descendants will stand to inherit the blessing. God has revealed that it was always his intention to put together a people who will be brought out from this existence of futility and death to be granted life in the age to come, based upon their inner commitment to the things of God. Thus it seems he started with Abraham, that is, that Abraham would be the natural beginning, but God has also been increasingly clear as time and the scriptures unfolded, that it is not on the basis of one's physical relationship to Abraham that a person is granted this inheritance. Otherwise, how could all the families of the earth also stand to receive this blessing as promised in Genesis? Rather, God is using Abraham as the metaphorical father. That is, it's those people like Abraham who hear and respond with an openness to God and his purposes, who will stand to receive the inheritance as his true children. Spoken another way, it's not the children of the flesh, but the children, as Paul puts it, who are of the faith and promises of Abraham. That people of God, the called out ones, both Jew and Gentile, the fullness, stand to receive the blessing of Abraham because of an inner commitment to the things of God. Now, by what standard has God ultimately measured a person's insides as being open and committed to him? By the ultimate standard of his unique Son, Jesus of Nazareth, who is his image. What a person does with this man, Jesus, is the ultimate litmus test for his openness to God. It is in this way that Jesus, not Abraham, has become the beginning and foundation for this new grouping of people. Now, I think that this is what Jesus has in mind in John chapter 8, and I want to go there for a second. This is a particularly enigmatic portion of John. If you want to turn there, feel free. I'm going to kind of paraphrase my way through it. But this is what I think Jesus had in view. He's talking to the Pharisees, and he says, he basically points his finger at them, and he says, "You guys think you're descendants of Abraham? Well then, why don't you do what Abraham did?" So he's going to start talking to them about this. He's discussing their lineage, and he says, "If you are Abraham's children, do the deeds of Abraham. You are seeking to kill me, a man who has told you the truth, which I heard from God. This Abraham did not do." And the implication being, how then can you be of Abraham, that is, of his lineage? And later in the passage, he who is of God, that is, of the lineage of God, hears the words of God. "For this reason you do not understand me, the Son, because you are not of God. I have told you the truth which I heard from God. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death." The Jews said to him, "Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, and the prophets also, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never taste of death? Surely you are not greater than our father Abraham, who died. The prophets died too. Whom do you make yourself out to be?" Jesus answered, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." The Jews therefore said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?" And Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham existed, I am." Now, there's lots of difficulties with this text, but ultimately what I'm going to suggest is, when Jesus says, "Before Abraham existed, I am," my suggestion is, in light of what we've heard from Colossians chapter 1, that what Jesus is saying is, in the purposes of God, I have always been a bigger deal than Abraham ever was, and I was always in view as the one who would be the starter of this lineage of the people of God, not Abraham. So I don't think it's a literal discussing of Jesus pre-existing before Abraham, but rather that it is his status that's in view as the beginning, as this foundation for the people of God. In this passage, the clarity of the Christ being the beginning and the foundation rings out. The people who are the true children of God are those who are able to hear the words of God. Well, there has been no clearer expression of the words of God than those words which were spoken through Jesus, the image of the invisible God. If one is able to actually hear his words and believe them, they are truly of God and stand to inherit the blessing, just as Abraham heard and was blessed. Now, so you'll notice that verse 20 follows, and by him the Son, the Father, is reconciling all people to himself. Now notice the fact that if it's people who are the fullness and they are in the Son, it makes so much sense with what he said in verse 20, because he's saying it's in the Son that all people are going to be reconciled back to God. Now, he goes on and he says that it is by the blood of the Son's cross that is how God is accomplishing reconciliation. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of the atonement, but I just think with what I'm presenting and my understanding of what I think Paul's saying here, I think that Jack's take on the atonement just makes all the sense in the world, that Jesus' death And our ability to see that take place and to recognize that he died the death that we deserved, that the magic is not in the blood of Jesus. The magic is in God giving us eyes to see and ears to hear what that death actually meant. And so I think that's what's in view here. That again, it's as Jesus as foundation and beginning, all people are reconciled back to God if God grants them the light to understand what it is the implications of the death really are. Okay, now, the very end, Paul says, and by him all, God reconciled all people to himself by the blood of his son's cross. And then he says, whether those who are upon the earth or those who are in the heavens. Now, this is, a particularly awkward phrase. You'll notice that in the NASB, Paul, it has him saying, through him I say whether things on earth or things in heaven. Well, first of all, again, the reconciliation, God is not reconciling things. It's people that need to be reconciled. And there again, I've translated those who are upon the earth and those who are in the heavens. The word there, those in the Greek, is the Greek, it's the article, the neuter plural article. It's the same case and number as the other all things that I've translated people. I made a case for that 2 weeks ago. So I think Paul is talking about people here, and it only makes sense in view of the reconciliation that he's talking about. So the question is, who are these people who are on the earth, and who are these people that are in the heavens? I'm running out of time, and I have some conclusions to make, so I'm just going to kind of go through this fairly quickly. What I'm going to suggest is that those who are on the earth and those who are in the heavens is kind of a metaphorical statement. And I'm going to suggest that those who are upon the earth is a metaphorical statement for those people who are near, and those who are in the heavens is a metaphorical statement for those who are far off. Now, Ryan, how the heck do you get to decide that in the heavens just simply means people who are far off? Well, everyone turn to Nehemiah. Yes, Nehemiah chapter 1. Now, first of all, before I go into this, I could be wrong. This is a particularly difficult phrase, and it's especially difficult if you go with the NASB translation. What is it that he means? I say whether things on earth or things in heaven. I mean, it's not. So I'm just, in some ways, I've been begging the text to sort of grant me some kind of throw me a bone to help figure this out. And this may be the case in Nehemiah chapter 1. I'll let you decide. But in Nehemiah chapter 1, starting in verse 8, Nehemiah is praying. Now, he's been brought back to the land of Israel after the captivity, and he and this remnant of Jews are in the land. And he's praying to God, and he says, verse 8, remember the word which thou didst command thy servant Moses, and he's referencing Deuteronomy chapter 30, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. And that's already happened. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the most remote part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. Or something like that, yeah. So here we have, now I'm going to grant you it's in the Hebrew, but here we have a case where the term the heavens can't be literally referring to the outer reaches of the cosmos. Nehemiah is talking about people being brought back from where God has scattered them. God has scattered them throughout the face of the earth, the known world. And so what I'm suggesting is that Paul, when he talks of it in, possibly suggesting that Paul, when he uses this term, people upon the earth and people in the heavens, he's referring to those who are near and those who are far off. And I think the connotation is, I could be wrong, but I think the connotation is behind that, he's saying, you Jews and you Gentiles, those who are near and those of you who are far off. Now, take it or leave it, but it makes a whole lot of sense given what I'm suggesting is Paul's project with Colossians, that his main point is, Gentiles, you get to be involved and you get to be partakers of this inheritance. Okay. Some concluding remarks. Oh, by the way, the parenthetical statement with the back up under verse 18, C, with the result that he might be made first in all respects. All I'm going to say is this usually gets translated so that he himself might come to have first place in everything. Well, I think this is parenthetical because it doesn't follow from his argument. His argument is that he's the beginning, and let's talk about how he is the beginning. And I think I've made it a parenthetical statement because Paul has just got done talking about all the ways in which the Son is first. He is the image of God. He is the ruler over God's people. And he is the beginning. And so I think in those respects, Paul is saying, in all those respects, he's first. Okay, implications of my translation, my take on Colossians. First of all, the language and the themes and assertions of the New Testament are derived from the historical context of the Jewish Bible. The titles given to Jesus and the understanding of the apostles about those titles being applied to him must be understood in the light of making sense of that text, the Jewish Bible, first and foremost. Secondly, with this passage, we have a clear argument for the inclusion of you and I as Gentiles into the group who will stand to inherit the blessing of life rather than the curse of death, without having to become Jewish in our orientation to the Mosaic Covenant. Now, to us here in the 21st century, that kind of sounds like boring news. Ho-hum, yeah, we got that. Especially because, as Christians, we have always taken it for granted that salvation is for the Christians by faith alone. It is the church first who are the true people of God, not the Jews. Our salvation is a matter of course. It's the Jews who had better get their acts together. But the New Testament sounds a very different call. God will indeed save his people, the Jews. It's we as Gentiles who are amazingly going to get to be included in on the Jewish inheritance and birthright, not the other way around. We are the unworthy dogs who will mercifully get the crumbs from the master's table. We are the wild branches that will be grafted into the natural tree. And our fullness, that is the fullness of the Gentiles, will be surpassed by the glory of their fullness. The fullness of the Jews. But the whole fullness, Jew and Gentile together, will both be included in the kingdom of the Son. Now, if I'm also right about this passage, then there are implications for other passages in the New Testament. Is there really concrete, unassailable evidence for the Jesus of the Nicene Creed? That is the pre-existent, fully God, fully man in his biology, Jesus, who was the instrument used to create the world. Understanding the Davidic covenant and the very Jewish context and background of these passages in the New Testament calls into question the interpretation of those passages traditionally viewed as asserting these very Greek, not Jewish concepts. Number four, our perspective on Jesus should also change. Jesus is not the transcendent creator God. Rather, he is the unique man appointed to represent the person and authority of Yahweh, the transcendent creator God. As such, Jesus will be Lord and Master over the new heavens and earth, and he will be King of Kings, who will rule on God's behalf over all of creation, sitting on the throne of his great, 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 great grandfather David. It's through this understanding that the evangelical notion of Jesus as my friend is made ridiculous. And even more ridiculous still, the pop evangelical notion of Jesus as my personal genie god in a bottle. The idea of Jesus as Savior is still accurate in this new paradigm, but in a limited sense. He is for certain the one on whom salvation and the blessing of Abraham rests, but not because that was his sole role in God's story, that is, as Savior. Rather, the man Jesus' main role within the story that God, as author, is telling through the novel of his creation is the role of God himself. This man is the one and only true depiction for us, who are the other characters in that story, of the invisible, transcendent God. If we can bear to listen to his words and embrace them, then we have truly become disciples and lovers, not most importantly of the man Jesus, but far more importantly, we have become disciples and lovers of Yahweh himself, which is as it should be. For as the apostle states in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 28, and I'm going to take some liberty in paraphrasing it, even Jesus, the Son, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, will in the end himself be subjected to the God and Father who made him Lord, that the one and only true God of Israel may himself alone be preeminent. So, that's my take, and I would open it up for questions.
Are you at all suggesting that Jesus is finite?
I'm suggesting that the man Jesus doesn't have to be eternal for all the things that were written about him in the Bible to be true. And if that means he's finite, then so be it. In terms of God purposing that this one would be his image from the foundation of the world, he was eternal in that sense. But in terms of the physical character of Jesus, I think he very much could have been finite, that is, before he shows up in Israel. So.
I have to really commend you for many things, but since we have a short period of time, I want to especially commend you for having the courage to say such a scary thing that would have gotten you killed in times past, and maybe even today. It's certainly a litmus test of whether you're an authentic believer, to be able to say Jesus is God. And a lot of people say that, and I'm not sure they really know what they're saying. They just know that's the right thing to say. We definitely don't have any indication, I'm not aware of any indication in the Old Testament that suggests that the Messiah who is to come would have anything more special, not that this isn't special, but anything more special about him than being God's designated one.
Mm-hmm.
Or one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to ask, I think if you were to have asked Abraham, is the Messiah to come, will he have some kind of identity with the Father? Apart from, in addition to being designated the one, will he have some kind of identity with him? Abraham would have said, well, gee, I don't think so. I mean, I don't have any reason to think so. So it seems like we've put a lot of importance on that idea that is not justifiable. That being said, there do seem to be some things that suggest that Jesus, there's more about Jesus than, you know, God could have picked any human being and said, you're the one, and you're my preeminent creation. I've created everything for you, and you are going to be the Lord over all this creation, that there's something more going on. And I was just wondering what you would, I can't remember where it is, but it talks about, I believe it's talking about Jesus did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant. So that sounds to me like there's more going on and than God just kind of randomly deciding to create a man who is perfectly good and making him the one. That sounds to me like what I think Jax expressed it, God and Jesus have the same social security number. And I haven't heard it expressed any better. And what I've sort of thought of it is God put, it's like that thing that's on TV. I don't have cable, but I have friends with cable who tell me about this, where the boss becomes an employee in the company and actually acts like a plain old ordinary member of the company to see what's going on really among his line staff and that kind of thing. He is, in that situation, he is an employee. In fact, he is subservient to the people who manage the departments that he's working in, who sometimes are rather plain-spoken about how he doesn't meet the grade. He's got these two identities. So I'm wondering, what do you think about that? What do you think's going on in that did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped?
I just so happens that Rusty Rexius has done an amazing job with this particular passage, and that is a discussion that would take way too long for me to answer that. But the context of Philippians, where he's saying that he's writing to a group of fairly affluent people who he is saying, you need to recognize that Jesus is your exemplar. You who are fairly affluent and of high status, be as Jesus was, who, although he was, you know, appointed as God, he humbles himself even to the point of death. And I think there's nothing in the language there that indicates that he came down from heaven or anything like that. So I don't have time to go through all the specifics of that one, but does that make sense?
It gives me something to think about.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Margaret.
The use of the term fullness is, I'm thinking about the filling out of the sail on the boat, mm-hmm. You know, the air that fills out the sail. And it's sort of like he's got this project, he's got X number of seats mm-hmm. on the boat, and I got to fill those seats. And when I get all those seats filled, we're done. That kind of fullness?
Yeah. If he means literally he's got X number of seats in the kingdom of the sun and the fullness is getting all those seats filled, okay. But certainly I believe that God has destined and marked out those children who are going to be his. And so the fullness is that group, both Jews and Gentiles, who he's already marked out. And so the playing out of history is him bringing those people into. So, you know, in terms of the number of seats, I think that's an interesting question, and maybe.
Or is it a reference to time? In the fullness of time, in the when this thing comes together in the end, I will have all my own?
I think he certainly talks about the fullness of time in Galatians. I don't think that time makes sense here in Colossians, but certainly that same word comes up like that, yeah.
So I want to say, first of all, thank you for doing this, for doing obviously a lot of work that you put into this. And also, I want to thank you for the emotion that you have for this. I think that, you know, we have a lot of church history behind us, and there's been a lot of theological and philosophical debate that has gone on at a very, very high level, very deep level. You know, you mentioned the council in Nicaea, but there's been a lot of those and lots of writings, and a lot of it's quite technical, and it really gets into trying to figure out exactly what this word means or that verse means or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's easy for us, I think, today to kind of throw up our hands and just say, you know, that just all gets in the way. You just got to feel it. You just got to, you know, you got to have that personal relationship with God. You got to, and there's a value in that as well. But I think if we get to that point, we often base our feelings and our emotions on theology that comes through that history to mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. And we get to it in a very sort of uncritical way. And in order to get to something that's maybe more true or closer to the truth, it often takes a lot of hard work that can sometimes be fairly technical. And at times it can be difficult to do that work and to feel like, you know, is this of real value? Because it seems maybe even dry at times. And I just want to say I appreciate the fact that you did a lot of work here that a lot of people might think is dry by having to do the technical work in order to cut through a lot of stuff that we take for granted. And yet at the end, when you get down to what it really is all about, it is really it's still a very staggeringly profound and deeply personal on an individual existential level mm-hmm. For each one of us to face into. And it's really getting at not arcane ideas, not how many angels on the head of a pin, but it really is getting at, you know, who really is this Jesus, and what really is, you know, what's my relationship to Yahweh, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and what is this really all about, and why am I alive, and where am I going, and those kinds of things. And so I just want to say thank you.
Thank you, Tucker. Yeah.
Thank you also. I have two questions.
Okay.
Short, hopefully. First of all, I love what you've done with Pleroma. Fullness. I mean, it makes so much sense. In light of that, what are you doing with it in chapter 2?
Thank you. I actually wanted to do that. So chapter 2, verse 9, I would translate it. I really appreciate you saying that. So I would, if you want to turn there, chapter 2, verse 9, what he's just got done saying in verse 8 to his Gentile readers is see to it that no one persuades you. And he uses the term by philosophy and empty deception, that no one persuades you by those things with respect to, and I'm going to suggest that the traditions of men and the elemental principles both refer to the Mosaic covenant, to the Pharisaical Judaism. So see to it that no one takes you captive to those things with respect to Judaism. For it, verse 9, for it's in the Son that the fullness, that is all the people of God, that is the fullness of deity, it's God's people. It's all the people of God, Jew and Gentile, that dwell in him as a body, that is bodily, they dwell in him. Which I just think makes so much more sense than the fullness of deity dwells in him in bodily form. And again, you can see that the translators of the NASB very much think that it's talking about his ontological nature, something special about him, that sort of thing.
Thank you. The second question I have is your verse 20, where you're talking about upon the earth or in the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if there's any chance it could be, since he's talking about the fullness being the people and the groups, all of them together, and he's also talking about the from the dead. Is there a chance that could be on the earth is living people, and in the heavens, those who have gone on before us will also be a part of this fullness?
So like those who were pre-Christ and those who are after Christ, that sort of thing?
Yeah, or anybody who's dead.
Yeah, maybe. The thing, though, is that, that's a possibility. In Ephesians, and I would suggest that Ephesians is absolutely, just as Colossians, Paul is taking on and letting know that his readers that they as Gentiles get to be included in. So he uses that phrase, those in the heavens and those upon the earth and those in the heavens, a couple times there. One of the things he says there is, I bow my knee before the Father, who every family on earth and in the heaven derives its name from. And there I think it's very clear that what he means is both Jewish families and Gentile families. I won't go into why I think that's true, but I think that just makes much clearer sense than talking about those who are already dead and those who... And the heavens here is not... this is not the eternal heavens. This is just the firmament, that sort of thing. Yeah. Thanks. Okay, I have to let you go. Thank you very much for listening.